This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue, and joining me, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo. Cuomo, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm all good, sir. Honored to join you guys.
All right. Well, have you been on the program before? You've been on this program before, haven't you?
I can't remember the exact day, roughly a year ago, we were talking about providing better support for those fighting on the ground.
All right. So you understand how this goes. Next time I'm back in Quantico and doing my post-traumatic winning thing, I want you to come see it. I'd be curious about your thoughts about it.
I would be honored to.
It's amazing to me, and I was talking about this earlier today, that we, as a group, we don't talk about our stuff, right? Until it gets so bad that we have to go see somebody to talk about it. But it's absolutely amazing to me as I think about that, why somebody wouldn't stand up and say, hey, look, I'm going to give you all some advice, okay? That doesn't work. You have to find somebody to talk to about your stuff. And if you do that, you can get through anything, okay? But one thing that we as a group have learned, that not talking about it doesn't work. It only takes you to bad places. But it's like nobody ever says that. And it's just, I don't know, it's just, as I thought about it last night driving home from Camp Pendleton, talking to the regimental commanders, the separate battalion commanders of the division, I thought, man, you would think as an institution we would have arrived at that. And as operational leaders, we would be about that. Hey, boys, girls, let me tell you something, okay? If you want to live good lives, given the trauma that you'll experience in this organization, here's one of the things that you got to do. Don't try to stuff in the closet because it won't stay there. I promise you. So, anyway, any thoughts about stuff like that? You're a deep thinker.
Well, I don't know about deep thinker, but no, I think you're spot on, and I think it's part of the reason. And the co-authors and I wrote the piece that we did. I mean, we got to talk about whether it's traumatic stress from, mental injury from close combat or what we do for our country. I mean, people are like, come on, man, you're comparing. No, we need to talk about what it is going through our head. What are we attempting to do? What are the stresses? And all too often we don't, or we're, I don't know, or we're encouraged not to. I mean, and sometimes the encouragement, I think in most cases, if not all cases, is not overt. It's just understood as part of our culture that you don't do that. And that's not healthy, whether that's at an individual level or increasingly, I don't think it's very healthy at the institutional level.
You know what? Well said. Because as you were getting ready to phrase that, I was choosing your words, and you chose the same words that I did. Because for instance, like Grandpa, he fought in World War II, and he never spoke about it. Yeah, but he was at the VFW at 4 o'clock every day getting drunk, right? Well, yeah, that's probably not the outcome that we're looking for, And so, but it's odd that operational leaders wouldn't stand up and say, "Hey, let's talk about this stuff." So let me transition that into this. The article that you're one of the writers of is called "Not Yet Openly at War, But Still Mostly at Peace: Exploit the Opportunity to Become the 21st Century Force That Our Nation Needs." Written by Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo, Captain Olivia Gerard. Is that how you say your name, Gerard?
That's correct. Yes.
Right, Major Jeff Cummings and Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spatero. It seems to me I've seen the name Spatero before. I'm not exactly sure where. But
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, he is VMU 1 CO. He's written a good bit, long and short of it, back to our initial conversation over a year ago. He's been battling for multiple years now to get better armed remotely piloted aircraft to support Marines on the ground. So if people see his name, his call sign Spool, and he has demonstrated just a boatload of moral courage to simple things. Like we spoke about Marines fighting on the ground or Marines are fighting on the ground. take the type of plane, take industry, take it all out of it and say, if that was my kid on the ground with his or her friends, what are some of the attributes that you would want the plane to have? And Spool starts with things like, I don't know, maybe it should be there the entire time they're fighting, instead of it's got to be a fifth generation, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And he's then said, okay, well, there are aircraft that can actually do that. And he's busted his butt to do that, and now he's doing good things with his Marines down in VMU-1, supporting General Alfred's team over in Afghanistan from 7,000+ miles away. So that may be how you know his name.
That's exactly how I know his name. And I remember the interview, and what struck me about the interview is it was his moral courage, because that wasn't the drumbeat. That everybody else was marching to. Okay, tell me about this is swimming in the intellectual deep end of the pool for the Marine Corps, because even those rubes among us, as we watch budget fights and we see weapon news, we look at the dwindling amphib fleet, we look at how quick the Navy is to offer it up in budget fights, and we say, well, wait a minute, that's the franchise, isn't it? So even the biggest rubes among us look at that with furled eyebrows and say, wait a minute, how does this work? I mean, that's our ticket. That's what we do, yet the Navy's giving it up. The Navy's not interested in it. And so I think that is even in Rubeville, it's an issue that has people thinking. But I want to ask you before, so that's the general backdrop question. Not yet openly at war, but still mostly at peace. That title doesn't make sense to me. Why did you choose that? It should say to me, not yet openly at war and still mostly at peace. Why did you put but in there instead of and?
I'm glad that you honed in on that. Maybe connect a couple of the themes. Going back to you asked, initially you were giving an example of a World War II vet. I'm going to the VFW. And then you jump to the amphib fleet and the Navy pressure. To that title, we are, in a sense, traditionally we view warfare, at least in the Marine Corps, what right looks like is go to 29 palms, put a mass formation of whatever that is, and attack up a corridor. Well, what if we think about it in a way that our forefathers, with just incredible levels of heroism in World War II, and then you could even stretch it into Vietnam, fought to get ourselves and our nation a position in the Western Pacific in this particular case, where we don't think we're at war every single day, but we are in a, and I don't say war of ideas, it is a war of what America stands for. It is a war for the prosperity, for free trade. And so we are not actively fighting in the traditional Marine Corps sense. In a sense, we are, if one looks at it from the way that China looks at it, going back to the 99 and the unrestricted warfare. So I don't know if that asks, or that answers the question. But the point as it relates to amphibs, and to try to tie all these things together, the Marine Corps has generally said, from a budgetary perspective, like you mentioned, hey, we need 38 amphibs. No real analysis. I may get punched through whomever's listening or whoever is, you know, hears about this and then says, what did he say? Well, why do we need 38 amphibs? And if you start with saying, hey, Pete Ellis and General Lejeune and the great Marines in the 20s and 30s, that they gave us interior lines and forward positioning. So in a sense, we're in a war of ideas. We're battling an authoritarian system right now. From a traditional sense, we're still at peace. But we now need a bunch of ships, not 38, and they all should not come from California, North Carolina, with a minuscule number forward stage in Japan. And if we do that, we can help our nation solve a problem in very different ways than right now. It starts with, I need my 38 ships. I need 2 MEB amphib Jafio. I need 353 F-35s, and we never say, whoa, hold on. And this goes back to the decision class that you created at the infantry officer course a long, long time ago.
what problem are we trying to solve? And why are those solutions, you know, whether it's the 38, the 353, or the two MEBs, how do those solutions solve the problem? So that's, we wanted people to hone in on that title and think about the competition and the warfare that we're in very differently. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It does. As an aside, I have a task for you. I feel like okay. I can do this because I'm a civilian. I gave, when I was down with the 2nd Marine Division in January, doing post-traumatic winning, General Furness said, hey, on Monday night, I want you to give your decision-making class. And I said, I'd love to. I love that class. So I gave it, and a few weeks later, he said, you know what, I'm getting the response to the post-traumatic winning thing has been overwhelming down there. But he said, you know the other thing that lieutenants keep coming up to me and talking to me about? I said, what? He said, is a decision-making class. He said, and get this, it's the infantry lieutenants that are saying that. I said, what? So I'm curious. He said they don't teach it anymore. Do you still know people where you could kind of, like, what do you teach if you're not teaching that anymore? And it seemed kind of odd that the lieutenants, the infantry lieutenants are saying, hey, that class is really cool, man. That used to be at the basic school in IOC, and so would you mind taking that as a task?
Yeah, and I'll run with that. I would. I gotta unpack that. The last I knew, and this is probably about 2 years ago, there was not only that class; there was a second class. So there were two decision making classes, and the second built on the first. So mm-hmm. I would be surprised, but I don't want to speak authoritatively, and something weird could have happened, but yes, to the point, if something weird did happen, something weird needs to be undone and getting back to, again, what problem are we trying to solve? Let's use our brains that way. But yes, got it for action, sir.
Okay. The well, and again, I relayed that to you from him because he said, yeah, it's infantry officers saying it, which has me confounded. Anyway, all right, here's what I want to do. I want to lay out the framework to spend an hour with you on this because, as I said, I don't know that we can unpack this in an hour. We may have to do this again in a week or whenever you have time. But you lay out in and first of all, thank you for sending me the PowerPoint. I enjoyed it immensely. You lay out a kind of an attack plan in a slide, and I want you to walk people, and I want to use that framework, the first five parts of it, in terms of how we'll go through this thing. And I'll try to keep us on time schedule, kind of like, you ever watch Pardon the Interruption with Michael Wilpon? And,
yeah, I gotcha.
Right?
Yes,
and
sir.
So if you hear me yell, all right, that means we're moving on to the next one. So if you could talk to people about kind of the attack plan and how we're going to go through this, then we'll attack it.
Okay, we'll do the best. And that was somewhat framed on the article. So the intro portion of this will be we'll kind of level it down, call it a leveling brief. But overarching, our co-author team thinks that our core has an enormous opportunity in front of it. You know, I've been in a beltway for a little bit too long. Hopefully, I'll be back in an infantry battalion. And you know, I don't know if it'll be. Maybe that's a subject whether we call it an infantry battalion or a close combat unit or something else. But any which case, there's an immense pressure on the Marine Corps right now. So the first part of this is how do you turn the crisis, the relevancy crisis? It's really an opportunity. So that's kind of – let's level ourselves on that. And then second, how did we get here going back to decision? So the second part of this will be where did this paradigm come from? Why is the Marine Corps designed a certain way today that most Marines don't even know the implications from a force structure, from a manpower, from a how we do requirements to the numbers that we put in spreadsheets? So that's the second part of this. Where did it come from? And then why doesn't it solve the problems that our nation has? So that'll be the second part. And then the third part is given the new guidance, and this goes back to FMFM1 and decision making, et cetera, we have had fundamentally different guidance through the 2017 National Security Strategy and the 2018 National Defense Strategy. Some people say these things happen all the time. The last National Defense Strategy came out now 11 years ago. So what based on, if you take those two documents, the strategic guidance, then you take FMFM1 or MCDP1, which emphasizes overwhelmingly in commander's intent that you need to understand two levels up so that you can then have harmonious operations and implicit comms, et cetera. So with the larger guidance, what's the overarching theory that the Marine Corps should work toward? That'll be part three. And then what would part four is, what does that theory for the future Marine Corps, given the strategic guidance, what does it look like in practice? And then part five is, these are the top eight things. You got to do a lot of things, but we got to nail home these eight things. And that's the kind of the attack plan. Does that answer your question, sir?
It does. And having done a little bit of innovative work in the Marine Corps, the most difficult thing to do when you're trying to innovate is to essentially unfuck the Marine Corps and take it someplace where it's never been. Right. And so it's all, and I applaud you for this. One of the things that you have to sit down and talk to Marines about is this. The genius of General Lejeune and Pete Ellis, right, is what we're attempting to tap into. The innovative nature, right, the real requirements, and the way they responded to it. We should be faithful to that, right? Not the infrastructure that was created in the aftermath, right? The infrastructure is not what we're loyal to. It is the creative process and the fidelity to the defense of the nation and our role in it that we're loyal to. And I think that at least that's in reading and looking at the slides you sent to me, that's one of the things you embrace. So let me get out of the way and let you get into the opportunity, leveling context and background. Go ahead.
Okay. No, thank you. So I think we've gone through a journey on this article and the article processes. And some of this, for listeners, if you haven't read, there was an article that won the Proceedings Essay Contest last year titled How We Lost the Great Pacific War of 2025, or How We Lost the Great Pacific War. And the Navy's, or the PAC Fleet 2, for about a decade in a row, he was the author, and he writes about how the U.S. Navy gets their asses kicked sometime around 2025, and we fail. And then it's a discourse between the PAC Fleet commander, the CNO, and how they lost. But we're still kind of – but the point, when you read through that entire article, the Marine Corps is mentioned barely. So you got whatever it is, 2,500 words, and there's a sentence about at least the Marine Corps trained hard at home like it was war. So when you unpack Pete Ellis and the opportunity, Ellis and General Lejeune were solving a very specific problem. They looked at the Pacific after World War One, and then through the 30s and into the early 40s, Japan was given territory, and then they took territory. So when Ellis and General Lejeune were looking at the map, they said, hey, at some point, we may need to take all of this back. And then they built an organization, and obviously all the innovation and the great ideas and the incredible heroism and courage of the greatest generation, and then that extended a little bit beyond. But so that's not to take away what we're not trying to say that they did anything wrong. In fact, to your point, they did everything right. But the institution, just because of the way large organizations work, latched on to the actual things that they did, and we have that defining us today, rather than the very reasons for why they created it. So that's the first slide in that presentation. And when someone, you know, it's not uncommon for Marines to say, hey, well, Secretary Forrestal said after Iwo, the flag means the Marine Corps is going to, you know, when the flag went up on Iwo, that the Marine Corps will exist for 500 years. And then here we are 70 years later, and you had Congress last year, as you know, one of the articles that we mentioned in the article and then in that presentation from Breaking Defense says, wither the Marines. And I'll read there's a quote from a recent think tank report that says the Marines need to find a new role for themselves, separate and distinct from joint forcible entry / amphibious operations, will once again risk extinction. So that's a pretty extreme jump.
Exactly.
And so if we recognize that, and someone might say, well, that's just a damn think tank. What do they know? Well, if one reads the National Defense Authorization Act from the Senate last year, you'll realize that this isn't just a think tank. This is coming from the Senate Armed Services Committee. which if we go back to 47, you know, the fights in the Chowder Society,
right.
We had, it's almost 180 degrees out from where we were in the late 40s and early 50s. And someone said, well, that's just the Senate. Well, you can, you know, if anyone's listening and thinks that, I'm happy to provide House Armed Services Committee member similar statements that are from United States Marines, not from soldiers. So we lay that out, just kind of a lot of greatness in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. That greatness we have rested on our laurels to some extent. And so the opportunities that we lay out is tied to what does the national security strategy say? So, for example, I'll read a quote. This is a year and a half ago. It says, China and Russia want to shape a world antithetical to U.S. values and interests. China seeks to displace the United States in the Indo-Pacific region, expand the reaches of its state-driven economic model, and reorder the region in its favor. That is happening. We see that happening. That's the problem. We're a maritime service. We work with the Navy. And you have, one just needs to look at the South China Sea. Like, this is all happening. What is our service doing? We will say things like, we have 20,000, 23,000 Marines in Japan. We are forward deployed. Da, 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 da. Well, clearly, that is not deterring what China is doing right now. Does that make sense what I'm saying, Mac?
Yes.
And so the question, how do we take all of these great humans? This has nothing to do with the Marines in the Marine Corps today. They're doing everything, you know, as all generals. They're busting their ass doing. It's how do we take the forces that we have and shore up? And some Marines think what I'm about to say, I mean, sometimes I get eyes rolled, but it's important to understand, at least we think, as it relates to the leveling foundation. Our greatest generation fought for a rules-based order. What does that mean? That means, at least in our co-author's view, that means that we fought to expand our economy and democracies so that we would, the world, and most certainly our own country, would see a level of growth over the last 70 years that people could never comprehend. We have over 30 mutual defense treaty allies. We have 70 other, what depends on how one would define them, but very close allies. And so what our task is in the national defense strategy and the national security strategy is defend that order, defend our allies, defend our interests. And the beauty of it, if we look at it right from an opportunity perspective, is we have interior lines, we have forward positions, we have popular support. We just need to figure out how to exploit it. And I'll lead, and so some like, come on, man, that's cheesy stuff. What are you talking about? We don't need to focus on this. And I won't curse, but I've been yelled at sometimes. We don't need to focus on this effing da 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 da. And there's a slide in the article or a figure in the article and then in the brief. Most Americans don't realize, and most Marines, and to be fair to everyone, I didn't realize this. Over the last 100 years, going back Imperial Germany, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, the United States has never faced a rival until today that had more than 40% of the gross domestic product of our country. So China today is sitting around, and again, this depends on how you measure it, but China's, from a pure GDP perspective, their economy is 65% of the United States today. Previously, the largest rival we ever had relative to that was the Soviet Union in 1980.
And
so, that was at 40%.
Give that number. What was that?
So the Soviet Union in 1980 had 40% of the United States economy. And that we didn't know that at the time,
right.
Obviously because of classification, but in the archives. Nazi Germany, 26% of the United States GDP.
What is Russia
today?
What is Russia today?
Russia today is just over 2%. Oh, excuse me, no, I got that wrong. That's of the G20. Russia's economy relative to the United States today is hovering around 6.7%. So we, to include as we speak, if you go to 29 Palms, you are fighting Russian units. And when one asks oneself, the Russian economy is 6.7% the size of the United States, so its ability to generate war-making capacity is less than 10% of our own. And if you measure it from purchasing power parity, the Chinese economy is already larger than ours. And there's some debates on the best way to measure it. But the point here is over the last 25 years, the Chinese economy has exponentially outgrown any type of predictions. And with that, they have taken advantage of things like America's signing of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in 1987. So they've bought 2,000 plus intermediate range missiles, ground launch. So Marines are very familiar with what I'm about. All weather, launch from the ground, not like airplanes who, if it rains, they don't work, da 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 da. So the Chinese today have fielded over 2,000 intermediate range weapons that they can employ 24/7. And just for listeners, as a scale point, so if we say, just in what I'm about to say, if you think about it from a costing position and then just an overarching competitive strategy, on a pure gross domestic product perspective, the Chinese economy, 65% of the United States today, we have never had an enemy larger than 40%. China can buy 1,227 DF-21 carrier killer missiles for the price of a single Gerald Ford carrier before you ever even put a human on it, much less a jet. As that relates to the Marine Corps and our amphibs, that equates to roughly 525 DF-21s for one USS America LHA-6 class ship with six F-35s, Bs, and no humans on it. So the takeaway here is we are on completely the wrong side of the cost curve. And we're not taking advantage of all of the rules-based, all of the allies. Why would we not get, and this goes back to your decision, this is where we say we've got an opportunity. This goes back to your decision-making class. We have all of these allies forward staged. Why do we not distribute our force away from these mass units and leverage our maneuver warfare doctrine?
Right,
so that's us in a nutshell,
okay.
You know, as the opening. That's a huge opportunity, and we believe the Marine Corps can do this if we commit to it better than anyone.
All right, part two, the amphibious paradigm that no longer solves the right problem. Go.
Okay. So in the presentation, that there's an image of the Japanese Empire in 1941, basically on December 7, 1941, and it stretched across the Central Pacific and obviously down through Southwest Asia. And so when we think about the amphibious paradigm that we have today, Tumeb Jafio, amphibious assault, there's been some interesting developments over the last 2 weeks, but if one is familiar or associated with Pacific Blitz or Cobra Gold, you can go back and to include last year and watch us doing amphibious assaults in these exercises. We have encouraged our allies to buy through foreign military sales equipment that enables them to do amphibious assaults. And this is all based on a paradigm that Pete Ellis built because the Japanese Empire required, if we were going to roll that empire back, all of these capabilities to assault. And then here's what a lot of Marines sometimes either dismiss or don't perhaps think through, and I'll caveat this because, you know, I suspect I don't know most of the listeners. I am a tried and true, love the infantry to perhaps more than life if my wife was standing here. I am executing the Commandant Strategist program right now. And so I guess what I'm saying, going back to some of the stuff from IOC, I've had time over the last year and a half to think about things in ways that most Marines don't because they're so busy. They're doing great things. They're just constantly suppressed. So when thinking about why the hell did Pete Ellis and General Ajern and amphibious assault and a two MEB amphibious joint force, well, it was because of the world as it existed, and it got worse and worse throughout the 20s and 30s and obviously into the 40s. So we created an operational concept called amphibious assault or whatever. And the purpose was to continue to move across the Central and in the Western Pacific and to get assets that were capable of delivering strikes against Japanese forces that were stretched throughout the Pacific and then ultimately the Japanese mainland. And so that's, and that paradigm is our paradigm today. if you go and read posture statements, you go and read how, if you went to Combat Development Integration today and you say, how do you make decisions on whether you buy an amphibious combat? It is all based on the Marine Corps force design at its core is based on we must be able to do two Marine Expeditionary Brigades amphibious joint forcible entry. And the number 38 comes from the assault echelons associated with that. And when you really pull on that, it doesn't include logistics. So it's really, you get into a lot of problems real quick when you start diving in the number. But in any which case, that's the paradigm. And in the presentation we mentioned in the article, when you get through Iwo and then you get through Okinawa in 1945, President Truman, why did he employ atomic weapons? Is because the American people did not want to lose thousands upon thousands upon thousands of infantrymen anymore. And so there's a quote here, after the bombs hit Nagasaki and Hiroshima, of President Truman saying on 6 August 1945, 16 hours ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. If they do not accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth. And then, obviously, Japan, which when one thinks about technology, the first test of atomic weapons is in New Mexico, July 16th, 1945. So less than a month later, these weapons bring Japan finally to surrender. Now, what's important about this, the year later, 1946, there was an exercise called Operation Crossroads in Bikini Atoll, and General Geiger, who commanded the forces in Okinawa, was there. And the purpose of it was to say, what happens if the enemy gets atomic weapons? What would that look like to an invading force? And so they laid out 90 ships, similar to what it would take to do a large-scale amphibious exercise. And five of them, a bomb blew up 520 feet above them. Five of the ships immediately, I mean, one of the ships went vertical and went straight in the air. But the takeaway from all the observers was that any human being that would have been associated with those ships would have been completely incapacitated or dead. And so General Geiger wrote a letter to Commandant Vandergrift in 1946 in which he stated, future amphibious operations will be undertaken by much smaller expeditionary forces, which will be highly trained and lightly equipped and transported by air or submarine. Air or submarine. And we highlight in the article, nowhere in there did he say, Given this, we need a high water speed amphibious floating something that carries 20 or 30 Marines and to expend the significant part of our budget or our budget on that. He didn't say that at all. He said 1946, if we're going to go ashore against a contested beach, we need to do it by air or under the water. Now, Marine Corps was kind of inching that way. And as I'm sure most of the listeners recall and have read or were part of, the service was challenged as the defense budget at the time got crunched in the late 40s. And then Operation Chromite, which we describe as the outlier, the single large-scale amphibious exercise conducted that our policymakers have ordered in the last 69 years, one. At Incheon.
But we were ready for it, Cuomo. Don't forget that.
And then you got to unpack what that means. And then T.X. Hammis does a really good job in his book, Forgotten Warriors. And the Marine Corps was about 74,000 guys at the time. When in June 25th, when North Korea invaded South Korea. And we grabbed Marines from just about anywhere. I recall Chesty Puller was in Hawaii, paid his own way to get to California. And this goes to the Fire Brigade of Pusan. The point being, when one thinks about this, a single time in 69 years, one time, the Marine Corps today cost the taxpayer over $43 billion a year. The service says what we provide the nation is large-scale amphibious assault. The service is being challenged on its relevancy and its cost right now. Big time. And we say, what we do is we provide large-scale amphibious. And they say, when have you done that? Well, 69 years. And then, of course, you get the General Bradley saying, we're never going to do this again. And the Marine, you can predict the Marine Corps responses.
Right.
Bradley said this, we did this. And when you unpack it, I said, whoa, wait a sec. We've only done this one time. Take away our uniforms, take away our pride, take away our history, and turn ourselves into civilians making investment decisions and say, we've only done that once in 69 years. My family has only done it once in 69 years. Am I going to spend $43 billion a year to do that? And then there's more important than just that. Since 1950, and when we laid this out in the article, few people, more do now, but a few comprehend when Osama bin Laden was killed, the dead group forces that went on the objective, we're talking 20-ish guys. I mean, I don't know, I haven't read the classified report, so I'll just talk about what I've seen in the news. But the bottom line, they were going into a third world, a poor country, whatever it is. Their mission was compromised. 20 guys moving 100-ish miles across the border, hugging the earth at 2 o'clock in the morning before the fast rope ever even hit the ground with the first SEAL's boot touching the ground. There was an individual in Abbottabad live tweeting the entire thing. And we think through a couple of whatever it was, 45 days ago when President Trump tried to go, when he did, but when President Trump tried to go to Iraq to visit the troops, covertly, some random dude in England took his telescope and said, hey, that looks like an interesting plane. Holy crap. That looks like Air Force One. And then they got on social media on a website that tracks aircraft and said, that doesn't have the equivalent of the right call sign. Hey, I think Air Force One is going to Iraq as they followed its movement. And so roughly 3 or 4 hours before President Trump ever even touched the ground in Iraq, the entire mission was compromised. And then on top of that, going back to what I mentioned earlier, so if you take the sensing, the Internet of Things, persistent sensors, companies like Planet Labs takes an image, 1.4 million images of the Earth every single day. So if the Marine Corps says our job is to do 2MEB joint forcible entry, and one of the elements that you need to have to be successful in something like this is the element of surprise, and you can't move 20 SEALs 100 miles against one of the poorest countries in the entire world without being compromised, how the hell are you going to do that? What does that mean for your investment decision? And then on top of that, you're going against someone who's got, in the Chinese case, they have 2,000 missiles that can start hitting you every step of the way from 1,700 miles away. So the paradigm as we laid out, you've had, and probably people who are listening, Mac, I think when you were an instructor at IOC, former Commandant General Conway wrote a command and staff paper on enhanced company operations in 1992. When he became the commandant, he signed a concept for it in 2008. Our Corps has not acted on any of that. We have fancy concepts. You can go back. Listeners can say, there's probably listeners saying, I wrote that concept. I wrote that the future will be more distributed. We're going to need more fires capabilities down at the lower level. Does that sound familiar with concepts you've read?
Yeah, and you got 60 seconds to tie this one up, because we're going to part three here.
Okay. So those concepts have been written, but if you go to CD&I today and you say, what is your design? They're going to tell you 2MEB Zephyr. So you don't have these capabilities pushed down. So the last quotes I'll read, we say, and then you can look at Cobra Gold last year, and we have a picture of in the article, the amphibious invasion that is part of Cobra Gold looks just like Incheon. So we write, in other words, regardless of what and how much has changed in the international security environment, the Marine Corps still holds steady to the belief that our force design must be married to multi-MEB amphibious joint forceful entry. The frameworks constraining the necessary conceptual and organizational adaptation required to honor the threats our nation faces. And then on top of that, last quote, you have similar to Congressman Vinson going through the 19 teams all the way up through his 52 years of service. There's a guy named Congressman Mike Gallagher in the House today, who's a Marine, who's arguably the most ardent supporter of the naval service, and he's written to listeners, I would Google Congressman Mike Gallagher and read all the stuff that he's written over the last 2 years. And he's written, he says, the naval service needs a new story about what the future fleet will do and how it will differ from today's fleet. And we must stop being always on the wrong side of the cost curve at every step. So the paradigm doesn't work, doesn't solve the right problem. When we created it, it was very innovative and it did a lot of great things, but it's not doing what our nation needs. So let's recognize that and let's use the same mindset that General Lejeune and Ellis had. And let's figure out a new approach that helps what America needs. Over to you.
No, well done. No, let me just tell you, I told everybody before you came on, this is a lot of stuff, and it's a lot of deep thinking stuff, and it requires a fair amount of footnoting, and you're doing a great job. But I want to get through the first, and we can have you back on, Scott, and we can deep dive on any one of these issues because they're all extremely compelling, especially as you begin to go through the footnotes of them, which is where most of the interesting stuff is. So, part three, the new USMC big idea. Talk about that.
Okay. No, thank you. It's funny, the footnotes. Colonel Woodbridge, or you talked to Colonel Woodbridge, we are incredibly grateful to the Gazette. It wasn't 2,000 words. It was 6,000 plus words. It had 130 something footnotes or end notes. And the reason people were, I mean, you're talking spears coming at us. And it's like, read this, man.
You can say it.
We're not making this shit. Read it. Well, he sucks. Well, then read this. He sucks too. Then read that. He sucks. Well, then everyone sucks and we know what's going on.
Exactly.
Just us, you know, as a service. But okay. So part three, and we don't, you know, and this is interesting, the feedback so far. We tinkered with the front of the article to be more kind of kiss them up front.
Right.
And we got a 3-star saying, you guys weren't bold enough. You should edit. And we laughed and we're like, okay, so you're the 3-star. But, yeah. And why is it? So I'm looking at the slide to start this. MCDP-1, I believe, you know, debatable, but I think the most important part of MCDP-1 in our warfighting philosophy is commander's intent. I'll read a couple of parts of this. We achieved this harmonious initiative in large part through the use of commander's intent, a device designed to help subordinates understand the larger context of their actions. And then it goes on and it says, further, in order for this to work, the Marine should understand the intent of the commander at least 2 levels up. So if we say we're Marines and let's go 2 levels up, you could say level 1 up is the Joint Staff, level 2 up is OSD. Or you could say, you know, go to the White House, depending on where somebody was. And so the next part of this goes to, okay, let's go 2 levels up. We have a national defense strategy for the first time in a decade. So what does it say? Let's stop with, the Marine Corps needs 38 amphibs. The Marine Corps needs 353. Like, let's stop with these rote. You will say this if you get asked a question, and if you drift from this, you get fired. Let's stop all of that and say, MCDP-1 says, listen, 2 levels up. What the hell does the nation need? And so the problem statement in the National Defense Strategy explains very clearly, eroding U.S. military advantage with respect to China and Russia undermines our ability to deter aggression and coercion in key regions, and China and Russia want to undermine regional balance of power and U.S. alliance and partnership constellation. And then it's, given that problem, the central idea here for the National Defense Strategy is to create more lethal, resilient, and a rapidly innovating joint force, and here's the key, combined with a robust network of allies and partners, and sometimes Marines scoff at that. But this, to Clausewitz, this is a huge, huge terrain advantage. But the point, we need to create a more lethal, resilient, rapidly innovating joint force together with our networks of allies, and that will sustain American influence and ensure favorable balances of power.
Anybody who doesn't understand that in the context of watching the developments around the South China Sea and the Malaccan Straits and the Belt and Road Initiative might not be worthy of the conversation. Like, look, go chase something shiny. We're going to stay in here and talk, okay? Okay, I'll be out here.
Right. And if one looks at to that point, if one hones in, and you can go to the Proceedings USNI website and look at the kind of where the fleet is, And if you hone in on a daily basis, now I would encourage listeners, go look at the last 2 years, hone in when they put up the fleet tracker in the South China Sea, the Strait of Malacca region, which Robert Kaplan, I'm sure most of the listeners know, I think he's at CNS now, but he's a brilliant guy that understands world geography and the economy and how everything, he's defined the Strait of Malacca as the 21st century fold the gap. Okay, well, if $1.2 trillion of the U.S. economy moves through that region, 9 million barrels of Chinese oil moves through that daily.
Which is what percent of their daily oil requirement?
It's somewhere between, depending on the source, 80 to 82%. So when one thinks about it operationally,
wow,
the Chinese economy requires 82% of the oil for the Chinese economy needs to move through the Strait of Malacca. And perhaps we can touch on BRI in a sec as it relates to this. But to your point, if one looks at where the fleet has been and where Marines are, and back to MCDP-1, there is an enormous freaking gap. Because we're not there. Because we're packed into Japan because we have a bunch of big ships. And we say the only answer to this problem is you need to give us more ships. And when we say more ships, we say those ships need to be traditional hull class. And an important fact that we go through the article, which we didn't really appreciate up front, Marines have a tendency, and, you know, depending on who lives, I may get yelled at right now.
Sorry.
Marines have a tendency to demand more of the Navy. The Navy must give us picket. And traditionally, it's, I need an LPD or an LHA or an LHD. And a lot of Marines, and I didn't know this, so, I mean, this isn't me taking a cheap shot. I did not realize since 2000, the United States Navy's end strength has dropped by 16.7%. So they've lost about 60,000 sailors since 2000, whereas the Marine Corps' end strength has gone up. Now it's about 1 or 2%. At times at the peak of the surge, when we were above 200,000,
right,
it was a little bit more than that. But
right,
the point being, one looks over the last 20 years, the Navy has lost 60,000 people. The Marine Corps has grown. And every time we say, I want an LHA, so I want a big deck amphib, we have just said, I need 1,000 sailors recruited, manned, and we know these aren't, you know, all E2s. There's significant rank structure associated with that. And then we need to multiply the number by 3 with the recruiting and then all the other associated schools. So essentially we're saying, Navy, not only do we're going to get our congressional allies to buy us the boat for the shipbuilding lobby, which that's probably the easiest part of this equation. Recruiting 3,000 Americans to continue to maintain that, that's an incredibly expensive. And so when you look at to the Strait of Malacca, the question is, hey, in 2019, in 2020, do you need a giant ship to reassure allies and partners? Is there a way to distribute forces, take advantage of our distributed decision-making, our creativity, our initiative, somehow figure out how to leverage artificial intelligence and swarming munitions? I mean, Scott, that's sci-fi bullshit in the future.
No. What it is, it's combining the tractor with the radio with an artillery piece and whacking, right, France in 6 days. That's what it is.
Right? So today, as we speak, there is not a Marine in any of the MEFs that has a TNR task or a training and readiness task condition standard. There's no Marine today that is told that his or her job is to employ a loitering munition at any range, whether that's a foot from him or her or 30 clicks or 60 clicks from him or her. ISIS in 2017, and I can send you live videos if you want to post it on, ISIS in 2017 employed at a minimum of 208 loitering munitions. And so that means simply going to Best Buy or on Amazon, taking a grenade and flying it and having a precision strike capability at a small unit level. So the question as that relates to amphibs, what happens if instead of saying in order to distribute in the Strait of Malacca, we don't need only 1,000 sailor manned $3 billion ships, why don't we have much smaller ships with distributed marine formations that take advantage of loitering, just like you said, they take advantage of current comm, artillery back then was, you know, whatever it was, 50, I mean, depends on the type of artillery piece, and the decision-making. So that's, and that's
on this part. So the approach of the National Defense Strategy, you know, and we'll build on it. It's kind of four prongs. It's expand the competitive space, and this goes back to your question about the title. Don't just think about the Marine Corps likes to do. I mean, you mentioned being with the division regimental commanders. I had the awesome opportunity to spend a while with them, about 6 hours last Tuesday. And so the strategic approach of the National Defense Strategy, 4 points: expand the competitive space, build a more lethal force, greater performance and affordability, and then strengthen alliance and partners. And to do that, there's the global operating model. I'll get back to the Strait of Malacca in a sec. The global operating model, as the National Defense Strategy lays it out, has 4 layers. The contact layer, and that contact layer is defined as activities conducted in the contested zones below traditional armed conflict to expose malign behavior and counter influence. And then the blunt layer is combat credible and warfighting oriented forces present forward to deter aggression or degrade, deny adversary objectives in a conflict. And people are defining that as preventing a fait accompli strategy from China or Russia, meaning something like China going to take an island in the South China Sea and saying, sorry, what are you going to do about it now? Right. Or Russia going into the Crimea saying, done deal, sorry. And so that's the blunt layer's purpose, is to prevent that from happening. And then the search layer is defined as war-winning forces that deliver capable mass. And then there's the homeland defense layer, which is forceful, capable of defending America in all domains. Well, we have been our leadership has said – I'm dancing around what I'm allowed to say, so that's what I paused there. You can find documents where our leaders have said we need to excel in the contact and blunt layer. Well, if you're going to excel in the contact and blunt layer, and you look, and those are defined as activities conducted below the level of traditional armed conflict, and or in the blunt layer's case, the ability to deter adversary aggression or to immediately, promptly counter it. Well, if one looks at the Strait of Malacca in the South China Sea, and you are not there, whether you're there, you're not there. Well, clearly you can't do that. So if that's Robert Kaplan's fold the gap of the 21st century, it's strategic maritime terrain. We are an amphibious maritime force. And we say if an adversary does something to an ally or a friend or an American civilian vessel, hey, we'll be there in 45 days. We gotta, you know, kind of mount up in California and sail across the world. Well, excuse me, wrong fucking answer. Wrong answer. That's not valuable. So the layers, someone that you know, I won't say his name here, when we were talking about the article last week, he asked, after he read it, he asked us to come in, myself and Jeff, two of the co-authors, because Poole was down in Arizona, and Olivia is over in Afghanistan with Task Force Southwest. He emphasized, like, viscerally, like a Marine infantryman getting angry. And he said, Scott, I don't know how, but you need to convince your senior leaders. They must understand if the Marine Corps fails in the contact layer, it equals the predicate to war. And that equals the Marine Corps has failed in what it's been told to do. And I'll say that again for listeners. Emphasize to the senior leaders in the Corps, if the Marine Corps fails in the contact layer, it is the predicate to war. And that means the Corps failed. And it was a rather succinct way of saying a whole bunch of things. And you think through that and you say, okay, so how the hell, whether it's the South China Sea, like how the hell are you going to be in all the places that you need to be in order to deter conflict and respond? And then the next part of the presentation, because I suspect we're running out of the time block here.
You are.
The Second Congress. We put it, and you have that slide. The readers, if they're seeing the article, probably don't see this. But sometimes Marines throw, we can't change because the 82nd Congress said we can't change. Mac, have you heard that type of? Right? So you're laughing, so I suspect it. The Marines say, okay, let's go look, like stop, and let's look at what the 82nd Congress actually told us to do. And it says things like hard-hitting, fast-moving, versatile, constantly have a powerful impact in relation to minor international disturbances. Such a force can prevent the growth of potentially large conflagrations by prompt and vigorous action during the initial phases.
It talks about a naval campaign, which I'm to provide a balanced force and readiness for a naval campaign. I'm going to come back to that in a sec. And then it closes with a force that's ready to suppress or contain international disturbances short of large-scale war. That's what the 82nd Congress wanted the Marine Corps to do, which sounds very much like the purpose of the contact and blunt layer. And as one of the regimental commanders said last week when he was looking at the way the global operating model was described, he said, Scott, you're getting at the number one tension in the Marine Corps today. And he pointed at the graphic in the article that has the contact blunt layer left and right of boom. And he said, we have been told, and he's pointing at it, we've been told to excel in the contact layer. Our service institutionally is designed, we've all been programmed to be in the blunt layer. And really, we want to be in the surge layer. That's really where we want to be.
Right.
Or winning mass formations. And I said, try to. And I, you know, so there's me standing in front of mentors, former instructors, guys I love to death and I, you know, do anything for.
Right.
And I'm like, gentlemen, I don't know what you'd sent me on this program. And, you know, half the guys in the room said, you're going to go do this and trust us, everything will work out. And I was like, okay, you know, did cross myself. But the point, I said, gentlemen, I don't know what to say. We live in a democracy. We were told these are the problems the nation has. We were told this is how we can contribute to the national response to make sure that we stay the preeminent power in the world and our way of life is that it, and some don't want to do it. I don't know if that's an option. It's certainly against MCDP-1 of understanding two levels up. So anyway, so we've probably got a minute left, and I bring that up just because the 82nd Congress did not say that the Marine Corps must have two meds and 38 amphibs and we will do amphibious assault. And the naval campaign component of that, so for listeners, the nation's shock troops must be the most ready when the nation is generally least ready to provide a balanced force and readiness for a naval campaign. And given modern technology, going back to the Devroux Compromise and President Trump being I think the paradigm shift, or one of them, that the co-author team and I, as we've wargamed this, because time has changed in the sense of you can be seen anywhere, in any way, shape, or form, and most readers probably listen to, for $60, a NATO exercise was compromised. As everyone figured, did you see this yesterday? They figured out.
Talked about it an hour ago.
Right. So let's take advantage of that. We don't need to move across the world. The maritime naval campaign is every minute of every day. Let's not think about this that we have to launch Pete Ellis's naval campaign. We don't need to do island hopping. They did that. Perhaps some of the listeners did that. These goddamn heroes did that. So we can now take advantage of the terrain and flip the map around and force the enemy to have to figure out how to move through the persistent sensing while they're violating international law, blah, blah, blah. But in order to do that, we're going to need to distribute. And so the last part of this, our theory, our big idea, whatever you want to call it, instead of the Marine Corps saying we do two MEB Jafio, we need 38 ships, we should say something like, given the national security strategy, the national defense strategy, if you want to go there, the 82nd Congress, we believe the foundation of the Corps' new big idea for 2019 and beyond should anchor on dominating time, the time domain for our decision makers, by employing highly maneuverable forward partnered amphibious close combat units that operate persistently throughout the contact layer's key maritime terrain with a Clausewitzian, attack defense mindset. And so two parts of that. In the article, there's a lead picture of the small boat with Marines walking from shore to get on the boat. We define that as an amphibious ship. Our service generally says, I need 38 amphibs. And I said, well, what if you had 300 of those? Well, that's not an amphib. So what the hell is it? It's Marines on land walking. It can move. Well, that's not an amphib. That's an alternative. I said, that ain't a goddamn alternative platform. If you can figure out how to, going back to your example in May of 1940, you can figure out how to put distributed units of mature, cohesive units that can make sound decisions because they're creative, they're American, America built it into them, and we can figure out how to leverage precision fires from all over the place and all these loitering munitions
Like, if the enemy wants to change rules-based order, well, fuck yeah, bring it. We'll attack your ass in every single direction, just like Boyd wrote about, you know, and just like MCD Drew talked about.
So, last one on this portion, the MAGTAF. The Marine Corps likes to think, and I don't know how to say his last name, but Rajiv Shankin, if I'm saying it right, wrote a book about the Marine Corps in Helmand. And then I was had the privilege to be a company commander in Helmand, and they defined it as Marinistan. And we, I won't say it on this net, but let's just say the Marine Corps ensured that we would put 20,000 Marines in Helmand, and we would fight together, and we would ask for a handful of other capabilities from other elements to come into Helmand. But it was a MAGTAF fighting largely on its own. That makes sense, Mac?
Yes.
All right. Well, stop. When we're going forward, we live in a world where 99% of, if you talk overseas, it's moving through fiber cables. America has 6,800 nuclear weapons for a reason. We have 30-plus mutual defense treaty allies. We have, our economy currently is still the largest. I think this is a Secretary Mattisism in the sense of the future is not preordained. Some people right. like to linearly traject the Chinese, you know, that they're going to take everything and they're going to be charging. The whole purpose of this thing is prevent that from happening. So if we say these forward deployed forces distributed, connected when necessary, and people say, Cuomo, Gerard, Cummings, Spataro, the network's going to get cut. And I said, okay, good. Let the network get clobbered. Let it get jammed. If you're using...
What do you mean, let it? It's going to be. Do you not think that that's reality?
Well, and the beauty of this, going back to the decision class that you created, part of our deterrent... I mean, people look at us like we're nuts. Part of our... And there's, for those that are reading it, there's a graphic. I think it's figure eight, or those who've got the article. There's a graphic...
Why you find it? For those of you just joining us, for the next 10 minutes, Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo has been our guest. We're talking about the future of the Marine Corps, right? And we've all seen the dwindling number of amphibs. And we've all scratched our head, and the Navy's desire to trade those at any moment for other capabilities. Well, what does that mean for the future of the Marine Corps? The article is on the electronic version of this month's Gazette. It's called Not Yet Openly at War, But Still Mostly at Peace. Exploit the Opportunity to Become the 21st Century Force That Our Nation Needs. All right. And my guest, who's one of the writers, along with Olivia Gerard, Major Jeff Cummings, Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spataro, is Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo. He is a former group chief at IOC. He and I crossed paths in his office one day when I was looking for something back in Quantico and a few years ago. So he's been gracious enough to come on today, and we're trying to cover all of the parts, and we're going to come close. So talk about the graphic you have.
Okay. So we're talking for listener Joe. We're talking about MCDP-1 and decision-making. So to throw some numbers out there, China's workforce, you know, so let's say the number one concern, they've got 65% of our GDP, da-da-da-da-da. China's workforce, 76% of China's workforce never graduated from high school. 76% of Chinese workforce has never graduated from high school. So when we think through that from a – we believe, I think our doctrine believes, that an educated Marine who is from a creative and initiative-based society, instead of if I'm a 2-year-old or 3-year-old, I have a 5-year-old son, if he touched my wife or my phone – in China, that goes into a social credit score that influences what he and his family is able to do their entire life. In our country, I don't know what the hell happens to it, so we really don't care what he does. I mean, I'm being somewhat flippant, but I'm sure you get the point.
Right.
But if you extend that, what that does to an individual over 15 years, imagine that if your child or your grandchild, whatever it is, you were concerned about any type of electronic thing that he or she did because it would impact what they were allowed to do from a state function controlled, monitored, when in. And so this graphic, figure 9 in the article, is saying sometimes you hear about the Chinese national commercial, national enterprise together, and there's no way that we can compete with it. And interestingly enough, it was kind of the same stuff that was said in the 1950s with the Soviets. But the graphic is showing all the way to the left is right now in certain areas, because they're so tight, China's, you know, in China's case, they got a strategy,
right.
The government's, you know, prioritizing funding in certain areas. They've got some advantages in the initial part of this thing.
Right.
But as a fight gets more complex, and if you're looking at the graphic, as you slide across the right side, you get to a point where it's kind of a set point, and then after that, the advantage goes to the system that, in a calibrated, chaotic environment, understands intent, and then can just create more decisions faster than that. This goes back to your decision-making class. And if we say, hey, we've got interior lines, we're the ones with the allies, we're going to forward deploy and distribute our forces all over the place, I don't need a MU commander with three ships to make a decision. I can trust a lieutenant, or as we lay out in the article, fuck a lieutenant. I could trust a sergeant. If I get the right sergeant,
right.
And this is if Tim Lively was on the net, and this is not if you're bring tears to my eyes thinking about the courage of young Lance corporals and corporals that I had the privilege of leading Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't want to use that word. These we don't have the reps. They don't have the certifications. As we speak right now, 20%, less than 19-point-something% of the Marine Corps' 648 rifle squads, less than 20% are led by a school-trained sergeant. If the infantry advocate were on the net right now, he'd be screaming.
Right.
So if...
But it's the truth. But it's the truth. We talk about, right, we talk about dispersed operations, right, but we haven't come to that institutionally. Right. And you can see where all this is heading, because, first of all, Mike Musselman says, hey, tell Como I said, what's up? He said, Como loves me. Let me just read you an email, Scott. Mac, first of all, what an awesome guest. All of us have been wondering what the fuck is going to happen to the Marine Corps. We are not going to get in given simply the surface to ship missile capabilities, we are not going to close on anybody's mainland. We all know that. So who's got an answer for us? Who's got an alternative? And it's refreshing to hear what Scott's saying. I'm sitting here listening, thinking about what he's saying, and he's absolutely spot on. You've said on this program before that you think China has an advantage right now, but that will dissipate over time. When I heard you say that initially, I thought you were full of shit. Como seems to be saying the same thing, that us, along with our allied partners in the region and around the world, will ultimately stand up to China, and they will have to take their place in a world of modern nations. Very interesting this morning. Thank you for having him on. I hope you'll bring him back again to deep dive on some of this stuff. We're going to have to, because we're going to run out of time here. What?
Humbling. Thank you, Mike. I miss you, bro. And obviously, this is lots of ideas
right.
from lots of folks. And just humbling.
All right. So, how much further can we get in about the next 6 minutes? Do you want to? Should we pause here and then come back next week and finish up? How would you care to do this?
I would be honored to do that.
Okay, so do this. Just tease parts 4 and 5.
Okay, so tease as best I can.
All right, in about 3 minutes, tease them, and then we'll bring you back next week, and we'll do parts 4 and 5.
Okay, so I'll do my best. So Clausewitz in On War lays out 6 factors that determine strategic success. And those factors are the advantage of terrain. 1 is the advantage of terrain. 2 is surprise. 3 is concentric attack. 4 is strengthening the theater of operations. Think interior lines. 5 is popular support. And 6 is the exploitation of moral factors. We think about this, and our job right now is to defend and shore up and consolidate the rules-based order. To Mike's email that he sent, we ain't doing nothing wrong. I mean, I'm just going to talk plain speak as can be right now. America is doing nothing effing wrong. Our allies are doing nothing wrong. We're trying to make sure that their sovereignty stays in check.
Right.
We're trying to make sure that the free flow of goods, going back to General Washington, stays good to go. It is China that is challenging all of that. So it is China's problem to overcome the advantage of terrain. They want to attack us. They got to leave their shores. They got to extend their supply lines. And they're violating international law. They're violating our alliances. You pick it. So let's. So when we come back, think through, to Mike's point, we have no interest. I'm a Princess Bride guy. But what? I have no interest in putting a division on mainland China. None. Zero. Nada. Zilch. Why would I do that? If they want to change rules-based order through force, they're going to have to do that somewhere. So what we're being asked to do in the National Defense Strategy is when their commanders, you know, pick up the map and they look out in the world and they say, how would I do that? When they do that, they say they ain't nothing but surfaces out there. This is a really bad idea. And so I leave you with that. And then you think through, what are the implications of that? If I were the commander and I was going to pick, I'm a PLA commander, and I'm going to pick my eyes up, I'm going to look across the South China Sea or the East China Sea, and I want to use force, not to fire 30 missiles or 80 missiles. I want to fundamentally change the political system in one of America's allies and partners, a democratic system. The only way you're going to do that is by putting human beings on this ground for a really goddamn long time. And if the people there don't want that to happen, and we're partnered, locked at the hip with them to help prevent that, and we do that right, it's one giant surface that then deters them. So think about how you would change the Marine Corps that you know, that you serve so honorably in. How would we do that? What would those formations look like? And again, I had the privilege of instructing IOC to, you know, serve as the group chief, the director. Like, I love the infantry. I don't know if we should call it the infantry anymore. Now, before everyone listening wants to shoot me in the face, if by the word infantry, the Marine Corps thinks immediately what comes to mind is 800 yards, 550 yards.
Right.
And we can't get beyond that. And this is, anyone can be in the infantry. I can have an 80 GT score. If that's what the word infantry immediately brings to mind, then we can't call it the infantry anymore. I don't care what you call it. And I think Secretary Mattis's Close Combat Task Force gives it. I don't know if you call it close combat. I don't know. But those forces need to be the ones that you are comfortable with. And most importantly, our policymakers are comfortable with distributing in the contact layer. And one Marine describes them as distributable. And the only way that you're distributable is if you can leverage all elements of national power at a moment's notice if you need to. Not that you have to do it every second. You don't need to network up every second. It means you've got capabilities to defend yourself. And maybe the last one, a friend has yelled at me on this article and brief, Scott, all you're asking for is fucking corregidor all over again. And I chuckled. And, you know, of course, I appreciate the feedback. And, you know, the co-authors weren't there.
Right.
But I asked them, I said, did we have 6,800 nuclear weapons when Corregidor happened? No. Did we have worldwide conventional strike? No. Based on the president's decision with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which, as it relates to this discussion, prohibited us from having 500 to 5,500 kilometer artillery or long range fires, whatever you want, conventional, not I wish the end wasn't. No, none of those existed. So imagine that these distributable close combat units, I mean, I'm comfortable calling them infantry if we can get out of our paradigm. Imagine that they're manned with the guys that Jim Lively's been fighting his ass off to get. Imagine that they're connected not to a JTAC or a JFO, but we're going to have to call it something different.
Right.
It's all weather, it's joint something. I don't know whether it's all weather persistent fires from the Clausewitz from every direction. It can leverage cyber fires. What does that look like? And so maybe leave it there and just think through how would you do that? Forget force design from two methods. Like start from square one with what the nation needs us to do, and there's going to be boats, there's going to be water, There's going to be locks. There's strategic lines of communications. And I think if we do that, and the co-author team, like, the future is incredibly bright for the Marine Corps. So over to you, Mac.
Scott Como, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps. Let me just tell you, this is the most comprehensive thing I have seen out there. And as I went through it, not only the article, but Scott was gracious enough to send me a PowerPoint with speaker notes. And as I went through, and as like most Marines, pictures help, it gave me the first hope I've had that, hey, we are ultimately going to head to a better place to be more relevant, or maybe as relevant as we've ever been, maybe more relevant as we've ever been, as this thing gets created. And we've talked about it. Like, we've stuck our toe in the water on a bunch of this stuff, talking about, you know, the squad leader of the future, right, and this and dispersed operations. But we're faking it, in my opinion. We're faking it. We're talking about it, but they're still clothed in the same formation, right? And we still don't have the institutional answer to how do we get all those squad leaders who are going to expect to operate like that to become operators like our lieutenants are at the infantry officer course. You know, how do we do that? You know, and we're not doing it. So, but the article and now listening to you have given me the first hope that I felt that, you know what, we're gonna wind up fighting about it. But we are headed for a better direction, one that in which we're not always bitching about the Navy's lack of love for amphibs, a vision that the Navy can fully embrace and say, yes, that's what we see too. So, first of all, congratulations. And, you know, you and I have both done institutional change. It's not easy. And it's much better, easier to convince people that, look, we're going back to our roots, the roots of Pete Ellis. Right? And what Pete Ellis was loyal to and what General Zoom were loyal to were not, right, any group of structures or any type of landing craft or any process. They were loyal to the creative solution of the nation's problem of defense. That's what they were loyal to. And I think you rightly said at the start of this, we lose focus of that, defending infrastructure. And we need to be the leader to get out beyond the infrastructure and say, yeah, let's make sure we stay relevant. So first of all, congratulations. And don't be afraid. I mean, I know you're not, but I would encourage you not to be afraid to be a shit magnet, which I know you are, because where you're taking us as a Corps and the nation is to the place that it needs to go. It absolutely needs to go. So congratulations.
Well, humbling on behalf of the team, and you know, there, and I know that they would all say our four names are on there. This has been many. I mean, you know what I'm about to say. Many a GO who I love to death has told me, in some way, shape, or form, most if not all of what's in that, and they'll say, I can't say that, or I think I can. You know where I'm going. Yeah, so I'll sort of shut up there. Aside from saying humbled, honored, for the Marines listening. You guys did great for us, and it's us. It's on us right now to figure out how to adapt. And, you know, and maybe the last point, what's so unique right now is there's been debates about what we should do. Now we have very clear strategic guidance. That is a fundamentally different. If we were having this conversation 2 years ago,
right,
we could say, well, I think.
Right.
Well, that's kind of mildly interesting.
Right.
I mean, it's not mildly interesting. I mean, one can assess the world and, you know, where things are going. But right now, we've got very clear strategic guidance, and the question is, how do we take FMFM1, understand two levels up, and freaking figure it out? And I'm confident. I mean, there'll be some ups and downs, but I'm confident we'll figure this out. So thank you again, humbled.
No, first of all, one of the great fraternities in the Marine Corps is the fraternity of guys that have gone through the infantry officer course, because you're really fortunate to get there, and the guys who do get there tend to be good instructors. They tend to be readers and thinkers, and you get to meet them and spend time with them and really get a chance to study your craft and teach it, and it's an incredible experience. And so I was with a few of them yesterday, Jeff Kenny, Kyle Ellison, you know, and so George Schreffler. So all these guys, I talked to Chris Bronzy on the phone yesterday. These are all guys who have worked in Mitchell Hall, and it's an incredible fraternity, and very proud to be part of it. And, Scott, thanks for doing this, and God bless you for the work you're doing, and don't be afraid to take that face shot.
Awesome. Thanks so much, everyone.
Well, hold on. Let me, one email. Mac, I have a question. What is the response like in terms of percentages? Is he getting more favorable or more negative when he gets feedback? So if you were to measure it and rank aside, is it more favorable or more negative?
Now it's more favorable. A year ago it was a little bit different, but now it's more favorable. So that the presentation that you've referenced a couple of times, we created that over the last week on request of our senior, I won't say what rank is that, I'm not sure what, but multiple senior leaders asked, can you put this in a presentation format and can you go give this? Not to say we don't want to read the article. It was none of that. It was,
no,
you need to stand up and like drill. I mean, humbling, like when you're reading it, you're like, so overarching, it's been favorable. I mean, there's quite a bit of what do we do? What do we do about the large program? What do we do about, and then these are clearly complex issues, and there are jobs across America, and you know, at the end of this, I think this is just Marines need to do what Marines have always done and just tell the American people, hey, the guidance has changed, and let's take the F-35 as an example. When those requirements were written in 92, 3, and 94, if anyone listening right now would have said, hey, I'll bet my family that the Chinese economy will be 65% of the United States in 2019. If someone were willing to do that, I mean, find that person. I would love to talk to that person. But the larger point is, we need to say, hey, we've made a huge investment in this platform. You have. The American people have. But shit's changed. And we got it. It sucks. But let's figure out. I'm not saying we don't need a single F-35, but we need different things. Let's have a conversation about what those different things are based on the guidance. And that's where I think to answer the question, it's favorable. It's increasingly more favorable. And it's, I think the biggest thing, and maybe this is something to think about over the next week or in any Marine conversations that you have Marine to Marine or Marine to, you know, Marine to senior leaders in the Corps now, how do we help explain to America? And this is a larger, some people think this stuff should be classified. I had this conversation 48 hours ago. I said that America has 30 treaty allies. We want to classify this? We're a democracy. This is nuts. No, we need to talk about this and explain it to America. And if we explain to America, hey, you know, the whole like Google won't work with us, right? Like that whole AI, and we put that graphic in the article for a reason with respect to Google's fiber lines throughout. Google's business model is to spread free ideas and instantaneous access to information. And in that figure three, you see where Google is spending billions of dollars to move fiber lines through the world's maritime choke points. Why don't we say, hey, like, we're serious. Just like General Washington told us, we need to defend those maritime choke points. America needs those choke points. Your company needs those choke points. We're just trying to help. That's a very different position than, hey, can you make me an autonomous weapon to go fly down in whatever country? And, like, that's a different – no, we don't want to have that come. So I think – it's favorable. We're struggling with how do we communicate that. So, but I'm optimistic.
There you have it, Scott Cuomo. Hey, I will be in touch, and we'll do this again. I appreciate your time today, bud.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, sir.
There you have it. That is Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo. In case you can't tell, he's a smart guy, right? Masquerading as a grunt. More of All Marine Radio. The Gunner coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.